This is the Cloud Ace Podcast, bringing you the latest in cloud security through captivating chats with fascinating cybersecurity experts who are leaving their mark on the industry. Cloud Ace is brought to you by the SANS Institute and hosted by SANS fellow Frank Kim. And now, prepare for departure. We are cleared for takeoff. Here's your captain, Frank Kim.
Hello, and welcome to the SANS Cloud Ace Podcast. I am really excited today to have with us Bernard Brantley, who is the CISO at CoreLive. Bernard, it took a little while to schedule this, but super excited to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. Super excited to be here.
All right. Well, you know what? Let's go ahead and just dive in. And I like to start all of these conversations with a little bit of personal history, trying to get to know you a little bit, make sure that the audience knows kind of where you came from and how that might inform, well, what you're doing today. So can you go ahead and share a little bit about your personal and family history and how, if at all, that influenced your choice of career?
So I'll try and make a long story short, or maybe short story slightly longer. I grew up in the city of Detroit. Both of my parents were police officers. My dad was a homicide detective, investigated some pretty gory or pretty notary murders and homicides in the late 80s, early 90s. I say that to give you some clue into how my upbringing was. You know, I've got parents who are hyper-focused on finding bad guys, law and order, and really kind of being at the forefront of, hey, you need education, you need discipline, and we're also in this city of Detroit. And so, you know, for me, I learned very early on the really bad and the really good and the gray zone in the middle, and that with parents who were hyper-focused on making sure that I was raised the right way, the unique things I had to do to kind of get around a detective as a dad to still have fun, but also, you know, make sure I was doing the right things. And I think that's been a kind of core set of things that I brought with me to my career now, that, you know, the constant evaluation, the what's behind the thinking, the what does my actions or the actions of another actually mean for what it is that I'm after? And then how does all this shape up into something that's interesting that I can deliver on kind of like a daily basis or use daily? I think that investigative mindset was just ingrained in me from the start. I attended the United States Military Academy. I spent 3 years there. I failed an English class and left the United States Military Academy and kind of spent some years in the in-between trying to figure out exactly what it was that I wanted to do. But, you know, all in all, kind of, as I said, the investigative background that I got from my parents and the kind of upbringing and the context of the city and the jobs that my parents had, as well as my entry into one of the best institutions in the United States of America and the route and path of learning that they gave me then, kind of has shaped the Bernard you see today.
Wow. Well, that really makes sense how you know, from an early age, got a little bit of that curious mindset, a little bit of that hacker mindset, as you said, maybe evading some of your dad's detective tendencies there. So that makes perfect sense, you know, how you got into that. But then, you know, how did you first start in cybersecurity in particular, you know, going from kind of that maybe a little bit of that law enforcement influence and into cybersecurity specifically?
Yeah, it's interesting. I won't get too deep into the specifics, but in that figuring out period, I came to a time where I was relatively broke, trying to figure out what it was I wanted to do with my life. And as much time as I spent on the actual internet when I was at a parent's house or in a library or at school, I didn't have that Wi-Fi access on my own. And I wanted to figure out how to get it. So I did some research, downloaded my first Backtrack Linux OS, installed it on the laptop that I had. Broke that laptop, reinstalled it. I went through that period for a couple of weeks trying to figure out how to actually build and operate a Linux system and ultimately leverage some of the tools on there like AirCrackNG, AirDumpNG to gain access to a Wi-Fi that was out there. And through that process, I was like, huh, there's something to this. There's been very little that I've been like trying to, that I've been experienced with in my figuring out period that actually captured and maintained my attention. This has it, and it has had it. I think I can put something to this. And that led me into the career in cybersecurity. I dove into a data center, learn everything I could and started scaling up in different layers of both systems administration experiences, as well as initial early cybersecurity analyst experiences, all the way up and through to the CISO role I hold today.
That's great. There's no better teacher than that experience of playing around with things to achieve some goal. And it's funny, I'm giving away my age a little bit here, but I was kind of on the opposite end of that in terms of some very early introductions to security. You know, I had my first PC, which was a x86 clone. And back then it had a 5 1/4 inch floppy disk, and there was no internet back then. So I had to find software from somewhere. And a classmate said, "Oh, you need software?" Pulled out a 5 1/4 inch floppy out of his backpack and said, "Here you go." And that, of course, should have been my first warning signal. You know, that was my first introduction to a virus where it played Mary Had a Little Lamb on an endless loop over and over again. It took me a long time to figure out how to get that off of the system itself. So, yeah, you got to start somewhere.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, cool. So that was your early start. And, you know, in your recent career, you've been at a number of great technology companies, Amazon, Microsoft, now Corelight. You know, how do you think about your overall security capabilities and your security architecture, especially as it relates to cloud?
Well, I'll say first, at sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, but while you're lucky, you better get good. And so, as I mentioned, I started, you know, at a data center. I moved on to some pretty large companies like Microsoft and Amazon. And while I was there, I used that time to really learn everything I could about the on-prem and high-value asset space, and this kind of emerging idea that was cloud as I start in my time at Microsoft, and then all in when I got to Amazon. So as I think about the cloud in specific, you know, my true background is in networking. So I think a lot about how things are interconnected, what type of messages pass over that connection, what type of systems are on that connection highway, and what type of capabilities that allows an organization to have access to. It's really no different as we move to cloud. It's just that much of that layer is handled by the cloud provider rather than having direct control of it as an end user. So, you know, I've got a more informed view of the world now as a CISO and realize that this is all based on risk and the execution of business objectives. It's just the execution of business objectives happens in a cloud environment versus an on-prem environment. Our path to handling and understanding the threats that go on in either, especially earlier on in my career, 100% based on a threat model, and then the business risks that the business sees as the risk to using this type of environment and the risk to essentially execution based on the potential disruption in cyber, which could be the same as disruption via network performance management, change in configuration management, all those things. So I really don't see a whole lot of difference between the things that I did historically in an on-prem or data center environment and those that I did in cloud, only that there was a level of learning required to really understand, hey, this is what things look like in a microservices architecture. This is what it means when your identity plane is handled by a cloud management provider or a cloud provider versus some tool that I pick up off the shelf and have 15 years of experience deploying, configuring, monitoring, et cetera.
You know, so you're really talking about kind of those first principles and how that, you know, built up perhaps from your early days, you know, related to network security. But I remember when we first got connected some many months ago, and we had our first conversation, and, you know, I really thought that the way that you thought about your security program overall was very kind of leading, cutting edge, very modern in the sense of, you know, making sure that part of our conversation was about kind of the user and how do you get them involved and how do you not just push stuff down as the security leader themselves. Can you share a little bit about kind of that thinking?
Yeah, so let me attempt to draw a picture without an actual pen or a whiteboard here. There's really two things that we are focused on in security. The one is the data that we have to protect within the organization or the environment. All the structures, the systems, the environments are all centered around some type of data that is important to our company to, you know, maintain its operations, to deliver unique value, IP, et cetera. And so that data construct has an environment behind it. The route to access that data or to leverage that data is really in the power of the end user, whether that be the end user that's administering the systems the end user that is accessing those systems to see some type of value recognition, or the end user in the sense of an attacker who is trying to enumerate, exploit, and then ultimately destroy or steal from that system. So it's users on one side, data on the other side. The question becomes, how much friction is in the middle, and what is the source of that friction to balance the equation between usability or the potential for malicious access and the usefulness of the data? My entire thinking is around, and I mentioned that I came up in network, all of the connections that exist in the space between those two points are either areas to gain trust or lose trust. In an enterprise, I'm trying to gain the trust of the end user, because with my best controls, my best efforts, my best risk management strategy, all goes to naught when a single user who may have access to sensitive data or any other point in the system makes a decision that they don't care, or that I can't technically enforce upon them the things that they should care about. So I have to win the hearts and minds of the user base that I am securing in order for them to have the best opportunity to build into their thinking, to operate in a way that is secure and that is to the advantage of the organization and the enterprise. So my program, my strategy is built around reducing the level of friction an end user experiences in their route to gain access to data that they need to do to do their jobs, and then reinforcing for them how important it is that they recognize value as well as fully understand or embracing the security mindset. So, you know, there's a number of different ways that I do this. There's, you know, forums within my company. We just stood up a security champions program where we engage broader than just, you know, we hyper-focused on engineering and business ops because those are the juiciest targets for an attacker. But let's say the entirety of the businesses and all organizations, how do I bring folks in that are either willing to help, curious about security, or are able to impact the system in ways they don't understand, and provide them with the tools that they need to ensure that the things that we need to get done as a security organization happen. The second is, how do I democratize the value of the data that I have access to as a security team, or the capabilities and components within the system I have access to as a security team? And I see this expressed as, you know, creating a large-scale knowledge graph of not only the types of events and data that have interrelationship that are valuable from a security perspective, but that data also includes the relationships and representation of data that might be valuable to a business intelligence analyst, or to a human resources analyst, or to a finance analyst trying to do some level of governance. And so representing these things in that way, and bringing the mindset of everybody's here to help, people have interests that borders on security, but is likely aligned with their normal job functions, and how do I securely allow them to interact with the system in ways that gives everyone unique advantage to complete their goals? That's really the core of how I think about doing and building security program.
Yeah, man, that's probably one of the most well-articulated descriptions of stakeholder management that I've heard, because, you know, that's one thing that I find that security professionals, technology professionals, we are historically the worst at that in terms of, one, understanding what other people want. You basically just said, hey, you know, you got to figure out what other people want. Gain their trust. How do you potentially lose their trust? Thinking about it from that personal perspective. But then you also, you know, very clearly articulated, okay, well, not only what do they want, but then what is valuable to them by extension, what is valuable to the business, right? Demonstrating the value of the data itself. You gave a couple of really good examples, you know, one of them working with the engineering and ops team. Maybe we could double click on that a little bit. You know, how do you turn that into action? You know, what does that actually look like? Folks on your security team working with the DevOps or engineering team, you know, what does that look like in terms of giving them something valuable?
Yeah, I think that the first, so I think about risk in four separate areas. Two of them are kind of combined, but I'll name them and then I'll focus on the first two. So there is risk to customers, risk to execution, risk to opportunity, risk to reputation. on the risk to customer layer and at the risk to execution layer, the risk to customers is how do we represent ourselves as a point in the customer's supply chain? And I think the most common way of understanding that is, you know, the all the tools and constructs we put around vulnerability identification, discovery, vulnerability management, change control. Those are impactful to the engineering organization because all the time that they spend resolving bugs is time that they don't spend on developing new features, developing new functionality. So by looking at the SDLC as a lifecycle, I won't dive into all of it, but if you think about, you know, the design phase within the secure design lifecycle and focus quite heavily on this is the risk that we pose to customers potentially through this design, and this is the risk on your ability to execute, which may materialize as vulnerabilities that escape our testing process that you got to come back and fix, or, you know, we've got NIAP that we're going through and they need some specific changes. We didn't think about them clearly up front. Now that's time that you've got to reallocate and make a trade-off decision around other things you want to deliver. Let's solve for that up front. And that way, not only are we delivering a more secure product, I'm giving you your time and flexibility back as an engineer to do the things that you really want to be doing anyway. And on top of that, we may find some new opportunities to deliver value to customers by designing it in a certain way that is a security capability or core capability that they come to expect or didn't know they needed, but once they have it, they can't see it being any other way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, our job as CISOs is really just to manage information risk, right? You know, that risk that you're talking about for the business. And, you know, to be honest, early in my career as a technical person, I didn't really think about that. I just thought about deploying cool new technologies, right? And, you know, kind of what was the aha moment for you where you realized, I need to talk about it in terms of risk, not just the technical controls?
Yeah, so I got some of it in my time at Amazon. You know, I led threat hunting and threat intelligence for their consumer payments organization. And when you're talking about large, large sums of money that move in and out at Amazon and to the partners that Amazon has, there's no way to only think about kind of the technical implementation details or the core security capabilities that I'm there to ensure are at a level of maturity that the business needs to be able to mitigate against outside threats. It is, hey, how are you thinking about fraud? How are you thinking about the impact to our partners when this system goes down because we've got to do incident response or refresh some portion of the system given that we discovered a vulnerability? And that was the aha moment that said, you know, if I disrupt the payments pipeline or I allow for the disruption of the payments pipeline or I did not anticipate a level of risk in the payments pipeline, that is multiple millions, if not billions of dollars of impact to people that are downstream here. Who else is thinking about this type of problem? And that elevated me up to chatting with the people that were in the fraud organization, folks that were over on the Intel side, and it started to broaden my understanding of who are the true stakeholders here in security and who am I actually managing risk for versus this small picture of, oh, I think an APT is coming after me. What do I need to do to stop it? And then when I got to CoreLight and really elevated to the CISO level and became peers with multiple different organizational owners, understanding how they saw the world and what was important to them, it's like, no, wait, you're not thinking about security. Or, no, wait, you need to think about putting these controls in. And the response was, I'm not going to say the direct response was, yeah, but I need to go generate X million dollars worth of revenue. We'll worry about the security portion later. But I started to see how the need for security could somewhat get discounted in a conversation where I wasn't able to elevate to, here are the explicit goals you have as an organization. Here's what it is you're actually trying to achieve. And here's how that can be disrupted by doing or not doing some level of security, taking on or not taking on some level of security initiative. And so that was like the big aha. Let me reshape things too. And if you look at my my yearly goals and 3-year strategy now, you don't reach the word security until you get a couple layers deep.
Mm-hmm.
It's, hey, how am I prepping this company to go public? How am I unlocking velocity in the go-to-market engine? How do I think about maintaining high customer satisfaction? What impacts can I have on this cultural evolution that we're trying to go through and layer in best practices so that folks don't have to question if they're doing the right things?
Absolutely. Yeah. Really well said in terms of kind of that mapping to those high level business and strategic objectives. Now, then for your team members, who, you know, of course, are focused on the day to day, you know, deploying in the cloud, securing various infrastructure, deploying new security capabilities. How do you make that mapping to those business objectives obvious for them in terms of the new tools, capabilities that they're building, working on a daily basis? And, you know, how do you connect those dots?
Yeah. So I'm the true translation layer. It's really me. I take the opportunity to try and enable a career development path for my leaders that gets them closer to understanding the inner workings of an executive team. So when I go to my functional leaders and say, hey, here's what we're looking at from a business perspective, which means that we need to either bring up or enhance these core sets of capabilities. You own these three capabilities. How do we get to this type of output from that capability, which helps us achieve this goal? And so I am the go-between in doing that direct mapping between, here's the high-level business goal, here's what security means for that high-level business goal, here's a set of capabilities that allow us to achieve this business goal. You own these things, which you know very well, but I'm also helping you understand how things are looked at, evaluated, trade-off decisions are made at my altitude, so that you can keep that in your back pocket. And people scale up and scale out at different points in time. But the key is that I try and create an environment where each time we go through a quarterly planning, so we do a year's worth of plan with quarterly business review and quarterly refresh based on goals achievements. Each time we do one of those quarterly refreshes or QBRs, my leaders are directly involved in that process. Something I picked up during my time at Amazon as well, which I'm moving the team to now, is, all right, functional leaders, you now own a monthly business review, which gets you to the cadence and communication altitude of recognizing those core capability goals and showing clear metrics in delivery and talking about it on a monthly basis in such a way that not only does a broader security organization understand, but if we wanted to invite entire company here, you're talking about things in such a way that folks that are in human resources, marketing, business ops, don't worry about the engineers because they know the technical stuff quite well. We don't have to worry about being a layer of translation there. But that the path to reporting and the thinking around how we talk about what it is we do are valuable not only to the security team, engineering team, but the broader company. Also something that's linked into how we stood up that security champions program. What's important to you? Bernard's got the exact altitude. You as an operator within these functions, or you as a leader within your specific organization, what's important to you and what are you not understanding today that we can help you understand better? And what is it we don't understand today that you can help us understand better, which maps back into how we represent the achievement of our goals or how we think through scaling up or scaling out the capabilities that we have in our goals architecture.
Mm-hmm. Great. Now, one key thing that you mentioned was that career journey and helping people see that and get to different points. Let's kind of maybe perhaps rewind a little bit and go back to the very beginning, not just for you, but for people at the early phases of their career in general. You know, you mentioned downloading Backtrack and playing with that, you know, kind of some of those early days. But what about for cloud in particular? You know, for you, you know, how did you build that cloud security expertise, not only for yourself, but also for your team members, you know, especially when it was newer some years ago?
I'm going to lean on some Amazon leadership principles. Be frugal and have a bias for action. And that really is around what type of constraints do you put on this kind of what seems to be boundless opportunity to go learn, interact, play with, and understand different things in the cybersecurity space or in the information technology space in general. By putting limitations on myself, which I've extended down to my teams of, no, we need to build this solution in the bounds of a cloud environment that has this specific structure. And we need to do this in a month, not 6 months, Now you tell me what it is that you think you can accomplish and where you need help. So for me, putting those constraints on myself to say, no, I'm not going to go do this on the Linux operating system. I'm going to go play in Docker. And no, I'm not going to do it directly in Docker. I'm going to go mess around with Lambda functions to try and achieve some of the same functionality. That was my path to getting to understand, learn, and how to execute in a cloud environment. By starting my people with, hey, you've got all this skill, you've got all these interest areas. No, it needs to be microservices architecture. You need to have it placed into the CI/CD pipeline. We need to do detection as code, and it has to land in a scalable way that we can deploy it via Terraform to all of our accounts. Now go. And it's a forced learning to where, hey, there's a couple paths to learning, or there's a couple paths to accomplishing this. You can extend something that we already have by adding new features or functionality to it. You can enhance it kind of in that same vein. You can go buy something, or we can build. And I try and bias away from building because it's expensive and it takes a lot of time. But getting people in the mindset of, oh, no, we already have this portion of our CI/CD pipeline contained here within this AWS structure. And what I really need to do is deliver these things to this part of code or to this part of the environment. Let me go hook into that and figure out what I need to do differently or how we may need to secure it differently to allow for what it is that I'm trying to achieve.
Love that. Love those two guiding principles. You know, that personally resonates with me, especially the be frugal part. You know, my wife would use another word for that sometimes, but yeah.
Make the best you can with what you already have access to.
Absolutely. Hey, kind of related, switching topics here a little bit. You know, what do you think it takes to get more people from diverse backgrounds into cloud and cybersecurity overall?
So there's the immediate, and then there's the kind of like, here's my vision for the world. And the immediate, I think that it's take advantage of the networks that you have access to, the people that you know, the people from diverse backgrounds that are in your organizations, the people from diverse backgrounds that are in your peer groups or your networks, and just go ask them, hey, do you know anybody? Before you go and throw, you know, your recruiting thing up on LinkedIn or on Indeed or whatever it is, hey, do you know anybody who may be interested? Or do you know a program who is building out, you know, a learning path for people who might be interested in this next set of roles I'm opening up? And can you introduce me? You know, word of mouth, especially in the security industry, you hire people that you've got trust in, and that usually comes from your network. And the more you can run that network and get trust in other groups, the quicker you are to make decisions around who it is and how it is we bring new talent into our companies. You know, it's maybe not the most fortunate set of circumstances that we exhaust our networks pretty quickly, and then we have to go to the big pool of candidates that are out there where you have no idea what the diverse inclusion is, short of, you know, what I would call bad practices, which is trying to spot via resume. Does this align with what I would think to be diverse background? Is this school aligned with, you know, those are not necessarily great things. So in the immediate, I say take advantage of the networks you have or extend your network to include diverse groups and diverse mindsets, and keep scaling that out, and then leverage it to make hiring decisions, to fill the pipeline, or to extend to other folks who are making the same types of decisions. In the longer term, I think it's hyper important that we start really extending cybersecurity education down to the K-12 level, and we make that universal. So in order to reach a more diverse group of people, there's two things that are required. One, they have to know what the thing is. And two, they have to see a path to either enjoyment or success through that thing. And today, unfortunately, you know, for a broad set of people, the first interaction with cybersecurity doesn't happen till well into college, like your sophomore level CS classes, or maybe even junior level, depending on what your major is. And people who may have just made a decision to pivot, you know, you've got some really interesting, you know, nearly aligned education paths that come into the cybersecurity space, especially as you think broader from I want to be a hacker or a defender into, I want to be a governance risk compliance analyst, or I want to be a data scientist. You know, there's some near adjacent learning paths that are there, but people don't find that stuff out soon enough. And so getting it to them much earlier in their education is, I think, extremely important to broaden the set of people who just will naturally come up and say, oh, this is something that I want to do, and now I'm going to go down that path, and just kind of naturally build a more diverse pipeline of talent. The second is that, hey, you've got to show folks a path to getting there that they themselves can buy into. Good or bad, I never finished college. So for those out there that are listening that say, hey, can I get into cybersecurity? I don't have a college degree. The answer is absolutely. Prior to getting into cybersecurity, I worked in retail. I worked in construction. I was a loan officer. So, hey, I'm in this other complete class of jobs or complete level of skills in these areas. Is cybersecurity all right for me? I'm here to say it absolutely is. But are there enough examples out there to show the broader group of folks who may be looking for or interested in career change that this is viable for them? I don't think it exists at a level that's either scalable or reproducible to ensure that the talent gap that we have today can both be filled, but also be filled by a diverse pipeline of people.
Yeah, great points. You know, it's like one is knowing that those options even exist for yourself, but then two is seeing that, hey, is it a possibility for you, for them? So yeah. That's great insight. Now, based on all of this, kind of what are you most excited about in cloud and cybersecurity overall?
Let me try and do this without jumping onto the buzzword bandwagon. So I explained a bit earlier that my background is based in networking and connectivity. And given that, until recently, I never had a true solution that allowed me to understand relationships within the environment, not in a meaningful way and not in a way that was scalable. You know, I could look at network traffic and for a limited set say, oh, here's a connectivity graph and here's a top talkers. And I can kind of infer what the relationship between these things looks like. Scaling that out to really see the network for what it is, which is a enterprise and systems representation of a social network and all the things that go on within that social network, there's a real opportunity to layer some of the same technologies that exist in the kind of commercial space around social networking, around advertising, around biosciences, and stick that right on top of network use cases. So the first part of that question is like this thought process around graph-based thinking and or leveraging knowledge graphs. The second, which is why I'm trying to stay away from the buzzwords, but now I can't get away from using them, is how do we leverage artificial intelligence and or large language models to better reason over a graph or a representation of the space that I'm securing in a better way? So how can I use AI or LLMs to reason over relationship-based structure of the world that's important to me? And so I'm really excited. I am excited about, you know, LLMs as they sit today. I am excited about some of the developments in AI. But what I'm really excited about is when we reach a point that the way we think about the interconnected world in, let's say, social media, like this person is friends with this person and this person is friends with this person, therefore I should advertise to them in this way, or I should connect them to this other person, and how that gets layered on top of cybersecurity, and then we can leverage AI to better reason around it. That's what I'm most excited to see happen.
Great, great. Now, let's switch gears a little bit. Let's mix things up. You know, we're doing a little bit of a role reversal here. We talked about this, doing a little bit of reverso rounds here of questions. So, you know, Bernard, I think you've got some questions that you'd want to ask me, and I think I'll in turn ask you those same questions as well.
Yeah, so we'll start with a completely non-tech one. What gift or what purchase of less than $100 have you made in the last 6 months that's had the biggest impact on your life?
The gift or purchase that I have made. Now, this is funny because you told me this question right before we started and I didn't really think about it too much. And so now you've stumped me here a little bit. Now, I won't say most impact on my life. You know, I was traveling in New York last month and I brought home a little trinket for my my son, a little Lego toy. And he really enjoyed that. And he put it together. Nobody else in the family had saw it. And they're like, oh, bro, where did that come from? And just a couple weeks later to hear him say, oh yeah, dad got that for me. You know, just a nice little memento, right? And you know, I guess I will say also in terms of something that I've bought myself, I just like things that are very nicely designed, well designed. And I've personally never been a car guy. I just don't like the maintenance and the upkeep and, you know, and all of that. But as I said, I like nicely designed things. And so I bought this one little toy, a car for, you know, me and my son. And it's in the shape of an American muscle car. There's another one in, you know, the design of a Porsche. And they're just so exquisitely made. I just appreciate it. You know, it's somewhat pricey for a toy, like $50. But, you know, just to even look at that and appreciate the design and how it's so well crafted. Yeah, that's just something that I appreciate seeing on the shelf every once in a while and playing with them.
Yeah, I as a reverse, I will answer the question. And it's interesting that we talk about our children that much. And it's funny that you mention a car because my best purchase under $100 is essentially the same thing. My son just had his sixth birthday. I picked up a small remote control car, but one that you had to build out of essentially Legos. And it had two options. So being able to sit down with him, see him open it, we kind of looked through the instructions together. I said, this one's more like a truck. This one's more like a car. Which way do you want to go? Being able to build that with him and then have him understand how the pieces fit together and why the wheels were over here and how the, you know, how we had to put the battery and the receiver on this side and we had the controller on this side. It was really engaging and fulfilling to see him kind of like light up and pick up. This is how things get put together and this is how they work. And he loves that thing. He plays with it all the time. I'd say for myself though, I buy a ton of books. But this one is not book related. I recently picked up let me not hype up some third party app that has it. I picked up one of those apps that does the 30-day calisthenics, like the 30-day calisthenics challenges. It's been really great. It's been really great to get back to focusing on health and being able to exercise daily. I was a college athlete. I ran track in college and haven't really had that level of direct kind of athletic engagement on a regular basis. This is it.
Right on. Yeah. You know, that's funny you mentioned that too. We've maybe got some similar things going on. You know, my wife has some workout videos via an app that we do together every once in a while. And yeah, you know, they're relatively short workouts, 10, 15, 20 minutes, but you know, it's a pretty good workout, especially if you do it on a regular basis. There was a point in my life many years ago where probably for, I don't know, 3 years, I didn't exercise at all, like really nothing other than walking from place to place. And it was pretty bad. So, you know, just having regular exercise on a, you know, daily, every so often basis, that makes a huge difference.
Yep. Question two. How has the set of questions you ask to stakeholders changed since you went from being kind of an operator to being an advisor, mentor, and investor?
Yeah, really good question. So, you know, I'll give a little bit of background here to the listeners that might not know. You know, I spent the vast majority of my career, over 20 years, in various operational roles from a technology and security perspective, different CISO roles, different security leadership roles, and, you know, security engineer, practitioner roles. Started my career as a developer, kind of building applications, wrote a bunch of bad code that I had to then figure out how to secure, which is why I got into security. And so, as you said, had various operational day-to-day roles for the vast majority of my career, usually in large enterprises. And it's in this last handful of years that I started to get more involved in startups and advising startups. And, you know, having bought a lot of security products over my career, you know, I saw a lot of different capabilities kind of come across the desk. And I thought, oh, well, you know, hey, it'd be nice to help these startups a little bit in terms of kind of their go-to-market journey. And earlier, you know, you had mentioned, well, hey, what's in it for the other person? What's their motivation? What do they want? You know, how do you build trust with them? And You know, so most recently, you know, I'm the CISO in residence at a venture capital firm called YL Ventures, in addition to continuing to teach with SANS and consult and help different organizations. And so to your point, you know, it's the similarities. There are similarities and differences. The similarity is that this is all related to cyber, is related to what's the problem that needs to be solved? What's that value, right? Whether it be the value for the CISO or value for the engineer. The engineer on the team every single day has some day-to-day problem. And it's really the types of questions that I will, things that I will discuss with the different startups are really all around that, right? Like, hey, well, why would somebody be interested in your product? You can't make it about you. What's the problem that you're actually solving for them? Both from the senior level all the way down to the engineer level from a product perspective. So yeah, is that something that you would actually buy? And I guess the differences in that are is that, you know, hey, I've got to put on more of a non-day-to-day operator hat in terms of thinking about, well, what does this mean from a market traction perspective, from a go-to-market perspective, from a marketing perspective overall, and an overall communications perspective. And really from a, it's really about kind of running the business. And I think one of the key things that I learned a little bit later, right, in my career as a security leader was that, well, how do I run the security team, not just as a internal technology team, don't just run it as a part of IT, but really run it as a business. Whereas I'm not thinking just about building the security capabilities. I'm thinking about, well, not only do I, how do I manage the budget? How do I actually grow, right? Grow the pie for other parts of the organization overall. And think about how do I get the word out even internally, right? In terms of promoting our various security efforts. So a lot of those things, fortunately, wound up translating over to the kind of the business side as well.
Excellent. And I'll ask you one more question. It's a little bit of a mod on the question I was talking about earlier, but what book do you most gift?
Yeah, that is a good question. You know, the I don't gift just one book because it's really dependent upon that person and that person's interests. So if we're thinking kind of a business book or a book from a leadership perspective, the one that I most commonly talk about and will share is Good to Great, right? Why Some Companies Make the Leap and Others Don't by Jim Collins. And I read that book years ago and I thought, oh, it made sense, but I didn't really kind of actively think about it, to be honest. And fast forward years later, you know, I read it multiple times since then. And there's little tips and lessons that, you know, where he talks about the flywheel and, you know, trying to get 1% better every day and kind of the discipline thought, discipline action, discipline people. And, you know, a lot of those principles, it's only when looking back, I can say that, hey, maybe subconsciously or perhaps inadvertently, I had adopted and the larger team had adopted many of those practices and principles in retrospect. And to kind of try to do a little bit of that every day really does help keep the flywheel going, whether it be from a security perspective, operations perspective, or from a business perspective. Now, depending upon the person's interests, you know, so I've met a number of people, you know, I like to make cocktails, for example, at home. And the cocktail book that I will most commonly give somebody that's just getting into it is called Cocktail Codex, created by the folks over at Death & Company. So yeah, really, you know, I mean, we can keep on going here, but yeah, depending on the person's interests, I will, you know, give a different book, right, of what I consider to be kind of a, you know, foundational book in that space.
Fair enough. I think for me, I'll do the cookbook first, but the flour, water, yeast. Mm-hmm. It's a book on baking. You know, it for me, the scientific aspect of cooking is extremely engaging in a way that I did not realize until I picked up that book. It's like, hey, why does our food taste the way that it does? And why is it that I put so much time into essentially these recipes or these frameworks that I do use for cooking different types of things and you know, the mods that I make in different quantities in different areas? And I got that book as a gift myself and said, you know what? This is perfect. So from a cookbook perspective, I think that is the number one that I gift. From a cyber perspective, there's a really interesting book by Aaron Brantley called Decision to Attack, Cyber and Military Decision Making. And it's interesting because it takes the kind of multiple domains of things that us as CISOs think about and puts it to a utility function, which allows us to be somewhat predictive about how it is that we evaluate the actual threats that are coming up against us and how to scale this up all the way to how do we evaluate the risk at a country level. And so I like to give that one out. It's pretty heavy, but it's one of those that's like you read it and you won't think about security the same way again.
Cool. I like the Flower Water book that you mentioned because that is on my personal list to read. And, you know, in terms of kind of the science of cooking and the science of baking, you know, there are a lot of similarities with cocktails and baking because, you know, one drop of saline solution, right, can make a big difference in the cocktail itself. And it's those small little things, right, that really impact the flavor of what you're actually eating or drinking.
Yep.
Well, hey, Bernard, hey, I think this kind of brings us to the end here. And hey, before we sign off, any last words of advice that you would give our listeners?
Be bold. Bet on yourself and be bold about it. You know, there were points in my career where I was unsure what the next step was, but I just decided to take it anyway. And that I can't say how things would have ended up had I not taken that big step or had I not believed in these kind of like broad, big goals that I had. But, you know, I reached a CISO altitude, which was always kind of like the target. Like, how do I get to that level? And I can say that it was only because I was willing to, you know, bet on myself and take those big steps. So do the same for yourself.
Love it.
Do the same for yourself.
Love it. Appreciate it. Well, hey, Bernard, it's always great to talk to you. Really appreciate you coming on the show. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you.